Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, and welcome to Cinematic Universe, a podcast that's all about comic book movies, brought to you by FilmDivider.com. I'm Joe Cunningham, and joining me to help make sense of the comics behind the movies are
Seb Patrick
and James Hunt.
We'll be discussing the latest comic book movie and TV news before launching into our spoiler-filled discussion of Louis Leterrier's 2008 film, The Incredible Hulk. But before any of that, I'm going to ask Seb and James to explain a comic book concept that, as a movie fan, I just don't understand. And this week, guys, I have read the first issue of Thor's, the Secret Wars comic, and I quite enjoyed it, but there is a character in there who I've heard of but know literally nothing about, and that is Beta Ray Bill. Can you tell me about Beta Ray Bill? But does he come from the Thor comics?
Yeah, no, he is a Thor. He's a Thor replacement.
Oh, he is a Thor. Okay.
Yeah, he's an alien who has his own version of Mjolnir, except it's called Stormbreaker. I forget why he was made a Thor, but basically they were impressed with his warrior skills and gave him his own hammer.
Okay, so he comes from, like a parallel universe?
No, he's a Chimelian, I think, which basically means he's a horse-faced alien. And, you know, Thor was just flying out in space one day and met up with him and was suitably impressed.
There's a really nice description of from Walt Simonson, who created Beta Ray Bill, of, well, a couple of reasons for him being the way... One, the reason why he looks the way he does, and one, the reason why he has the name that he does. so he says, you know, he sort of wants to create a new character to sort of be a new sort of temporary lead in the Thor comic. He said, my thinking was that comics are a short form, and one of the things that's mostly true about comics characters are what they look like. I designed Bill deliberately as a monster because I knew that people would look at it and go, oh my God, it's this evil guy. So he kind of didn't want it to be, you know, he didn't want people to know if he was a goodie or a baddie to begin with. He also said, originally I was going to call him Beta Ray Jones because I wanted a really common name. My feeling was Bill was every man for this alien race. I deleted Jones because there were too many Joneses floating around the Marvel Universe.
Can I just have a quick moment of errata? Beta Ray Bill is not a Chimelian, he's a Corbinite, which the Chimelians are different horse-faced aliens.
So what you're saying is that Bill did not vote for Andy Burnham in the Labour leadership election.
Oh dear, that is a niche joke.
I think that's our first ever topical news reference.
So does Bill tend to, is he a Thor character, or has he ended up in other series along the way? He seems like someone that would fit in with the Guardians of the Galaxy. Is that a stretch?
Like, he's one of those cosmic characters who turns up a lot. I would say he's primarily associated with Thor, but right. You know, he does turn up by himself. Kieran Gillen wrote a bunch of really good Beta Ray Bill one shots.
Yeah, he did a miniseries, didn't he?
Yeah.
I was just trying to think if he ever showed up in the movies, which I'm sure he won't, where that might be.
I mean, it would have to be in a Thor movie first, but he would be a natural fit for the Guardians as well.
Personality-wise, he fits quite well with the Guardians because he's a decent bloke. He's just, you know, as you know, he's just a fairly ordinary guy, despite the fact that he's a, you know, weird-looking alien creature.
Yeah. Well, I enjoyed him very much in Thor's, which is... I was surprised quite how much I liked it. It's like a pastiche of detective cop dramas, and Odin turns up as, like, the angry captain.
Yeah, the thing about Thor's is everybody absolutely loved the first issue, and then the second issue came out, and everyone was like, yeah, it's all right, not as good as the first issue. Yeah.
Well, I'm probably going to buy the second one, and I'll probably think that as well. Okay, well, let's move on now to take a look at some of the comic book movie news that's broken this past week. And we'll start off with a couple of casting rumours. The first one concerns the solo Wonder Woman movie that is going to be coming up. It was going to be directed by Michelle McLaren, now going to be directed by Patty Jenkins. We know Gal Gadot is going to be starring as Wonder Woman, but we don't know much of the other cast other than Chris Pine is on board to play Steve Trevor. That is a terrible character name. If you're going to have two first names, don't make Trevor one of them.
The fact that Steve Trevor has a terrible name is entirely in keeping with the fact that he's a terrible character.
Okay. Well, let me ask you about two more Wonder Woman characters, because apparently Eva Green and Sean Bean are being rumoured for the movie. Sean Bean would potentially be playing Ares, the God of War, and Eva Green will be playing, and excuse me if I get this pronunciation completely wrong, she'd be playing Kirki. Now, guys, first of all, do you agree with me that if you can put Eva Green and Sean Bean in your movie, then do it? And second of all, who are these characters? Are they any good? Would they be interesting roles for those two actors to play?
I think I would agree with that point. I'm amused by the idea of Sean Bean getting to play an immortal god in a movie, because it means that he might actually get to the end of a movie without being killed off, which would be
Isn't he Zeus in something? Isn't Sean Bean Zeus in something?
I don't know. They probably found a way to kill him anyway. They'd probably find a way to kill Ares. Yeah, so Ares is, well, he's a big Wonder Woman villain. I mean, he's maybe the main Wonder Woman villain.
Okay.
Interestingly, I didn't know this, but he was first introduced as Ares, and then from his second appearance onwards, he was Mars instead, because that's the Roman god of war.
Right.
And it wasn't until George Perez did his sort of seminal run. I say seminal run, I mean, I'm assuming it's good, but it's a Wonder Woman comic, so I've never read it. But by all accounts, it's the definitive Wonder Woman run by George Perez in the late 80s. And everything was kind of restored back to being very Greek mythology influenced, so he became Ares again. And I think the sort of the version of Ares in terms of the look that everyone would be familiar with is the George Perez version. And yeah, he's just, you know, he's the god of war, and he's a villain, and for some reason he hates Wonder Woman, so...
Okay.
Sean Bean would be interesting casting for it. I mean, I don't know. It's hard to get a handle on what he'd be like. I imagine he should be a quite imposing character.
Northern. I think he'd be very northern.
The thing is, Ares is kind of a... Like, as a cultural figure, you don't have to use the comics version, because he's well-established as a guy who is good at war, and that's the only trait you need, so...
Sean Bean playing God's Update, he was, in fact, Zeus in Percy Jackson and the Lightning Thief, so... Check out that Percy Jackson knowledge that I just threw.
He's working his way through the pantheon.
Oh, amazing.
I'm not looking forward to his Athena.
What about Eva Green, then? Who is Kirki?
Well, I know even less about her than I know about Ares, because, as has been established, even as the resident DC buff, I have not read very many Wonder Woman comics.
Sexist. That's very sexist.
Yeah, it is, yes. Well, I think I more than make up for it with the number of Supergirl comics I own. So, yeah, purely from the look of the character point of view, I can see why they would cast Eva Green as her. She's a villainous sorceress. From the look of it, she fulfills about every basic stereotype of a villainous immortal sorceress in a comic book. So...
God, that sounds that sounds perfect for Eva Green. she does great villain. She normally does great sorcery.
It does seem a bit odd to have Eva Green in a Wonder Woman movie, like, not playing Wonder Woman.
Yeah, that is insane, isn't it? Can you imagine Gal Gadot and Eva Green walking into a room and saying, which of these two actresses do you think is playing Wonder Woman in an upcoming movie?
This is like how I'm still bitter that Parker Posey was in a Superman movie not playing Lois Lane.
Yeah.
Still bitter, nearly 10 years on.
Over in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, Rebecca Ferguson is being heavily rumoured to be Marvel's favourite to play Carol Danvers, Captain Marvel. This is a role that has been linked to many actresses ever since Captain Marvel was announced. But Rebecca Ferguson, who's coming off basically a star-making role in Mission Impossible 5, which none of us have seen, so I can't comment on, but she might be in line to play Carol Danvers. And guys, because we don't know the actress very well, although I'm sure we all soon will, Could you tell me what you kind of think are the defining characteristics or attributes that an actress playing Carol Danvers would need? Like, what defines Carol Danvers? What do you need to be able to be to play her?
It's kind of tough to say. Like, Carol Danvers has had such a long history in comics, but until quite recently, there's not been anything you would call a definitive take on her. The primary quality of the character is probably that she's a sort of army brat. Like, she grew up in the army and, you know, did it as a career. And I think that's why Katie Sackhoff was such a popular choice for sort of fan casting, at least.
Right, okay.
Is because she has got all the qualities that you would want in the modern Carol Danvers, just in the role of Starbuck.
I mean, the other names that have been rumoured in the past have been, like, Emily Blunt and there was Ruth Wilson as well.
Yeah, Emily Blunt is the only one I know out of those two, but for me, that was much less of an obvious piece of casting. Like, obviously, you know, there's always something that they see that puts, you know, associates them with those roles, and it's like, you wouldn't have said Heath Ledger for the Joker, but that worked. So, for a Marvel movie specifically, I would say the one quality any leading person needs is good comic timing.
Yeah.
Because that's the only thing that, like, every Marvel character needs in some quantity.
Okay, let's move on now. We've got a couple more tidbits of news from Captain America Civil War. I'm sure these will keep dripping through. Both of these come from a Elizabeth Olsen interview. She was talking about the movie and mentioned that Daniel Bruhl's Baron Zemo will in fact be the main villain. But what Elizabeth Olsen also mentioned, very interestingly, and this is a direct quote, she said, "She's someone who's more powerful than she's able to control." This is about Scarlet Witch. "And she ends up going insane because of it. And she's like a wild card. You never know if she's a hero or a villain, and that's a very fun part." Which, I don't know whether she's talking about Scarlet Witch going insane in this movie. If she is, that's very interesting. But either way, it sounds like Scarlet Witch is going to be losing her mind somewhat in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And I wonder what you guys thought about that, because that comes from the comics, does it not?
It does come from the comics. I mean, the House of M storyline. I'm fairly uncomfortable with it in the context of the MCU as it currently stands. Because to begin with, the whole idea of kind of Scarlet Witch, you know, kind of going mad and her powers causing a cataclysmic event as a result, is a not very pleasant implementation of a particularly not very pleasant trope, which is, you know, hysterical, insane woman type story. And for that to then be folded into the MCU when they've only just established their second major female heroine, to immediately go down that route with her just feels to me to be spectacularly ill-judged. It's like, you know, we've waited so long for another character that isn't Black Widow.
Yeah.
And it's like, already by her second movie, she might be turning into an insane villain. And it's just such an easy fallback for Scarlet Witch. And it's just, I mean, back from immediately from the moment they first said that Scarlet Witch was going to be in the Marvel movies, I was kind of rolling my eyes because I thought, well, they're going to do that storyline with her then, aren't they? And, you know, if they do eventually get to that story, can we maybe have it, like, at least after they've brought Captain Marvel in? I know we've had Gamora in Guardians, but, you know, aside from, get Wasp along as another member of those new Avengers, get Captain Marvel in there. So establish that there are, you know, different types of good female characters as your heroes, and then maybe you can turn one of them crazy. But for the second one to go through that story that early, I don't know. Am I being oversensitive to this, or does it strike anyone else as a bit uncomfortable?
It's definitely, it's not what I'd do. Like, in fairness to what Elizabeth Olsen said, I get the feeling she's talking more about her process than the storylines that are in Civil War. I would hope it doesn't bleed it. Like, obviously, as an ex-villain, there's always going to be some level of uncertainty around Scarlet Witch's allegiances, and if they play that up, that's fine. But, yeah, specifically doing the insanity storyline, it's a popular story with the character, but only because it was
a big crossover event.
Sort of a it was a dramatic rewriting of everything that she had been for sort of 30, 40 years previous. Like, originally, Brian Bendis came onto the Avengers and wanted them to be dismantled, like, as a team, so that he could start from scratch, and his solution was Scarlet Witch is insane, and she summons all their enemies to destroy them. And from that point on, the only storyline anyone's ever successfully done with her is Scarlet Witch insane and rewriting reality, and it's like it's become lazy, and it's essentially wrecked the character. Like, some people have tried to pull it back from that, pull her back from that, but it's never really stuck.
It basically means now that whenever Scarlet Witch is around, you're just waiting for the other shoe to drop.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, I do think there's probably a way that the Marvel Universe could handle it a bit more delicately. I think you're right that she was a villain to begin with in the comics. And I think what a really cool alternative to making her just flat-out insane and turning evil would be to very clearly point out that she is the most powerful character out of anyone that we've seen. And if she learns to control those powers more and more, she has the potential to be the kind of, you know, the missing piece to all of this. Like, if she strolled onto either of Iron Man or Captain America's teams, then she would be the most powerful, you know, and would provide a huge advantage. And that if she is kind of, like, torn between two sides of whether to be good or whether to be bad, and if that's what she means by being insane, more that she kind of is torn between the two sides of things, I think that could be very interesting. Or that would be the interesting side of using a character like that.
It's interesting that you make that point, because as we discussed before the podcast started, she's not on the character poster, is she?
She's not on either side of it. She's not on those two lineups of teams that we've seen.
So it could be that they, having identified this quality for the character, they sort of, you know, sideline her fairly early on in that discussion.
Yeah, that would, I mean, and then she could be a very interesting power broker almost.
Mm-hmm. I mean, specifically thinking of ahead to Infinity War, you can imagine the Scarlet Witch playing a major part in the fight against someone like Thanos. Just because she's the only person we've seen who's got that kind of Infinity Gem level ability in her own right.
Okay, and to move on to our final piece of news then, and this doesn't really need much discussion more than it just does need to be pointed out. We got our first trailer and release date for Jessica Jones on Netflix. That's going to be on Netflix on November 20th, which is very exciting. And the trailer looked pretty cool and looked like it could be maybe part of what the opening credits might be. And also has an image that's very similar to Daredevil, so kind of makes a nice little thematic link there. You guys as excited as I am? I'm really excited.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't glean anything from the trailer, but it did just make me go, yay! And it just it just drove home again just how crazy it is that there's going to be a TV series.
The thing I quite liked about the trailer is that it was, it looked like David Matt covers.
Yeah.
It did, like, that's what feel. It reminded me of.
And it felt like it had the right tone. And it's very difficult to say that about something that looks like a title sequence, but it looked like something that would be befitting of an Alias adaptation.
This is just one of those things where the source material and the character are so good that it's got to be really difficult to screw it up.
Yeah, it's not like Daredevil, where you've got sort of 30 years worth of comics that aren't very good, and then Frank Miller's, and then nothing, and then Bendis's.
If you're basing it on those Bendis stories specifically, they're so good that, you know, it should be a bit of a no-brainer.
And I've never been as worried about this show as I have been during this last 15 seconds of you talking.
Well, I mean, I'm still not 100% sold on Kristen Ritter, and it's nothing against her as an actress, because I know she's very good. She is not what I would have pictured for Jessica. She's got an edge about her that I think will, you know, is right, but I don't know what it is. There's just something, she's not the type of personality that I would have had,
like,
in my head for Jessica.
Nothing I've seen of, like, shots of the character and stuff don't make me think, oh, that's recognisably Jessica Jones. Like, it could be a version of Jessica Jones.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's you can't, so far, you can't really criticise there's very little you can criticise in the way of casting in the MCU. You know, above all, it's the thing that they usually get right. So,
Okay, well, that brings us to the end of our movie news section. We'll move on now to our spoiler-filled discussion of The Incredible Hulk. But before we dive in, let's listen to a trailer for the movie.
I've got a problem. There are aspects of my personality that I can't control.
See a shrink?
It's a little bit more complicated than that.
Bruce, trust me when I tell you, I've heard them all.
Not this one.
We've never seen anything even close to your levels of exposure. That you survived an event like that, it's beyond my comprehension.
I don't want to control it. I want to get rid of it.
As far as I'm concerned, that man's whole body is property of the U.S. Army.
They want it as a weapon. If we let it go, we will never get it back.
There's only one thing that can fight that. It's in me.
Maybe if I can control it, I can use it.
Okay, so that was a taste of Louis Leterrier's The Incredible Hulk. This is a movie released in 2008, was the second movie in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And you can tell because Tony Stark shows up at the end. And I thought, before we dig into the movie as a whole, guys, I thought we could probably talk about some of the casting of this movie. And because I know you both have strong feelings about that, and I think that can probably go some way to kind of sum up how we feel generally about the film before we dive into some of the specifics of the plot. Is there any particular actors that you like or don't like, or do you think the movie does generally well by or badly by casting up its Marvel characters? Because I think we generally agree that the Marvel Cinematic Universe does a very good job at casting.
Yeah, and generally it does.
And notably, this is a film that had its lead actor recast when Hulk was being brought back into the equation.
I mean, like, this is, of all the Marvel films, this is the one where you can probably go, a lot of the casting in this was a bit off. I remember when Ed Norton was announced as Bruce Banner, thinking, like, that is basically the perfect choice.
Yeah?
And then, well, yeah, because, like, Bruce Banner is sort of, he's a slim, nerdy guy who has this kind of undercurrent of rage. And specifically, Ed Norton in Fight Club, like, he's got form in those roles. And so when he was announced, I was like, well, that's the perfect Bruce Banner. It looks like him, and he can act like him. But then in the actual film, he just seems like he's bored the whole time.
Yeah, I was gonna say, he just seems like he doesn't want to be there.
Yeah.
Doesn't he?
And he's meditative character. Like, he's very, not to me where he's switched off, but that he seems very laid back for a guy who is the Hulk.
Yeah. Like,
although Mark Ruffalo is so laid back, he's horizontal.
Ruffalo has this kind of nervous energy to him, though.
Yeah, and he has that sense of being uncomfortable in his own skin. I felt a lot.
Yeah,
of the time.
Exactly.
But,
yeah.
But we watch Ed Norton very early on in this movie meditate, and it seems like this is a character who, and this is one of the points of the movie. He's a character who is striving 24/7 to keep this guy under control, and he's trying to do that by staying calm and keeping his emotions in check. And so in a way I think that kind of fits the version of the character they're trying to show, but I'm not sure it's entirely successful.
Well, the problem is there's no difference between sort of him like repressing his emotion and not having any emotion.
Yeah. Repressing it just means not displaying it in this instance. It's a weird sort of, I think it's quite an interesting reflection on the Marvel universe as a whole, because if there's one thing that really characterises the Marvel films, it's that there have been a lot of casting choices that raise eyebrows when you see them written down on paper, that have turned out to be absolutely perfect on screen. And this, and even I would go so far as to say Mark Ruffalo, actually. When Mark Ruffalo was cast, I was like, really? As Mark Ruffalo as Bruce Banner? Mm-hmm. I couldn't see it. And, you know, he is terrific. He's completely nailed that character. And Ed Norton is the complete opposite, because as you just said, you know, on paper, that is a spot-on piece of casting that just, yeah. And I don't understand why he's so disinterested in this movie, given that he co-wrote it. It really seemed like it was a bit of a not exactly a passion project, but, you know,
yeah, that's it
seemed
it.
Like
I don't,
he was
like
into
he
went
it,
all in, yeah.
You know? Yeah, I'm not sure that he is disinterested. I think maybe if that's how it comes across, then that's fine. But I think it's unfair to say that Ed Norton was disinterested in this.
Oh, no, yeah, no, he comes across disinterested.
Yeah, no, sorry, yeah, I'm not saying that he's blind. Yeah.
It's not like
I'm amazed that it
just
comes
wanted
off
to clarify that.
Yeah. He's not Natalie Portman in Thor.
There are scenes and sequences where I do get the impression of him being more involved. It's really mainly in the first act. I quite engage with the character. Basically, as long as he's in Brazil, I really like that stuff, and I get on with the character. And it's after that I just lose all interest in him. I really do.
And can I ask, I mean, I'm going to have to make a confession here. I have never seen, and probably won't until we do it on the podcast, Ang Lee's Hulk. And I just wonder, how do you think how does Norton compare to Eric Banner? Was Eric Banner well received in the role, and was this perceived as kind of an upgrade or a downgrade or just more of the same?
I just remember Eric Banner being adequate. I like Eric Banner generally. There was nothing wrong with him in that film, but he didn't really stand out. I don't know what you thought, James.
Yeah, he didn't strike me as like the definitive Bruce Banner. All I remember is that I was sufficiently upset with his performance as Bruce Banner that when he was announced for the Star Trek reboot, I was upset with that as well.
Okay.
I do think that the 2003 film does, I think with the other main characters, I think the 2003 film does better with the casting.
Okay, so let's talk about those. Should we start with Thunderbolt Ross, who is played by William Hurt here, as he will be in Captain America Civil War?
William Hurt is a fine actor. He is one of those, you know, he's one of the this generation's strongest character actors. He is, for me, so woefully miscast in this. And I don't know if it's just that in the previous film it was Sam Elliott, and Sam Elliott is just perfect casting for Thunderbolt Ross. I don't particularly like Thunderbolt Ross as a character, but I love Sam Elliott, and he's perfect as Ross. I think the thing is, Sam Elliott's version of the character is exactly as you would expect a Sam Elliott character to be, which is that he's, you know, got a massive white moustache, and he's very gravelly voiced, and it's like he's, you know, built out of a block of wood. I don't mean in an acting sense, I just mean, you know, he's sort of very stout and resolute, and he's very cartoonish, but he is kind of that is what the character of General Ross is like, in as much as I've experienced.
Is General Ross generally he's a villain, but is he not the main villain, or is he the main villain?
Yeah, I wouldn't call him a villain so much as a thorn in a side. Yeah,
right.
He's the main antagonist.
Yeah, Sam Elliott, I just can't imagine not liking. Whereas I like William Hurt in this. That I'm drawn to him in a way, but I do always get the sense that he is a potential massive dick, and I like that sense of I bought him as this character, and I don't have anything to compare him to, but I thought he was very good, and I thought they did a very good job of turning William Hurt into white-haired, mustachioed Thunderbolt Ross.
Yeah.
The mustache has got nothing on Sam Elliott's mustache.
That's
well,
true.
Yeah, but that's a given.
Goes without saying. I think this is a fairly good version of Thunderbolt Ross.
If
the Sam Elliott version didn't exist, I would be saying this was a good, you know, this was about as good as it got.
Okay.
I just think he doesn't really have... I think it's that he hasn't got presence. I think he's just, you know, what I tell you, what William Hurt is playing well is a really unpleasant, snivelly general of a character who you do just, you want to see him get punched in the face.
I like the sweaty desperation of him.
Yeah, and I think it's just that's not necessarily what I would expect from General Ross.
It's definitely what I would expect from General Ross.
Really?
The whole thing about General Ross is...
I'll defer to you knowing the character better than me.
The whole thing about General Ross is that he wants to defeat the Hulk and he can't do it. And basically that is ruining his career, that he is tasked with doing this one job and it's a point of personal pride for him.
Is it that he wants to defeat it? Because in this movie he wants to capture him to use him as a weapon, right?
Well, defeat in the broadest possible sense of the word. Like, he wants to better Bruce Banner in whatever way that makes right. sense.
I mean, I don't know about you guys, but rewatching this movie, it really... I mean, I did think that if there was one character from The Incredible Hulk that I would be happy to see brought back for future movies, it was Thunderbolt Ross. I didn't... There was no one else that jumped out to me and went... Yeah, I'd be excited to see them again, or...
Well, I was going to say, it's not going to be Betty, is it?
or yes, I think they would fit in with what Marvel are doing now, 7-8 years on. I think Thunderbolt Ross feels like he could still have a part in this universe, whereas I was struggling to comprehend how some of the others would fit into it at all now.
Yeah.
You mean you're not looking forward to the leader being the villain in a future?
No, I mean, Tim Blake Nelson's going to be busy with his Fantastic Four sequel. But yeah, I'm fine with Thunderbolt Ross coming back. But as you alluded to, Liv Tyler as Betty. Again, I don't know this character at all, but watching it, I just found it so bizarre thinking, so technically the Mark Ruffalo version of Bruce Banner has this relationship in his past. it's so strange, and I couldn't comprehend watching Mark Ruffalo's Bruce Banner, who has been in a relationship with Scarlett Johansson's Black Widow, spending any time on screen with Liv Tyler's Betty Ross. It's just... It's bizarre, and Liv Tyler's not great in this movie, I would say. I think she has... but her and Ed Norton share little to no chemistry. And yeah. The worst scenes are when they're on screen together.
The best moment for her is when she's screaming at that taxi driver.
Yeah, like, it's like...
It's funny, and there's energy, and like, suddenly there's something there. And then in the rest of the film, she's like a kind of... simpering constantly on the verge of crying, it would seem.
And it's like, is she putting on that voice? Because I'm sure Liv Tyler doesn't usually have that soppy a voice in everything else I've seen her in. I like Liv Tyler, but by God, she's irritating.
She's fallen quite far since Empire Records.
It is becoming quite... I mean, like, if anyone ever tried to claim, oh no, blockbusters or superhero movies don't have a problem with female characters... It seems like it's something we have to discuss every week. Like, this movie does a bad job with that female character. Or this movie has trouble giving that female character anything to do. And I think, you know, it would be false to say it's never anything to do with the actress, because I think Liv Tyler doesn't deliver a particularly great performance here. But also, she's got nothing to play with, and she's got nothing to do. And... it is a very obvious trend just on the random films that we select to do on this podcast. It's a problem. It's a real problem. It needs fixing soon. Yeah, so that relationship is weak. We'll get to it more later on. But, I mean, what would make a better Betty?
It's a good question, that.
Is she a good character on the page? Is she interesting there?
Some versions of her are good. Like, as a... female character created in the 60s, there is a certain amount of damsel in distress to her. The thing, like, the primary thing you need is chemistry with the person playing Bruce Banner.
Okay.
Because, like, the idea is she's the thing that can pull him back from being the Hulk in terms of how that character is defined. Like, you know, they try and establish different versions of her where she's a scientist or, you know, she's in the military or whatever, and it's always... the only thing that matters is how she relates to that character, to Bruce Banner.
Well, what you're basically saying is the key thing that this film needs is what it lacks. Or the key thing that this character needs, the movie has none of, which is chemistry between Betty and Bruce.
Yeah, but the thing about Betty as a character is that she has to be strong enough to stand up to the Hulk and look him in the eye when everyone else is scared of him.
Yeah.
And, like, no version of her on screen has been able to do that convincingly.
And it seems like the Marvel Cinematic Universe is done with her in the same way that I presume they will eventually be done with Jane Foster.
Because it's found a character who does do that.
Yes.
Yeah,
but it's not her.
One of my favourite things about Age of Ultron was that they had that little in-joke of calling the Hulkbuster arm of Veronica, because that implied that somewhere out there Betty was still around. And like, as much as I dislike Liv Tyler's version of this character, I would like to see her back, because I think it's an important relationship for Bruce Banner that they've kind of kicked to the curb a bit.
But what I think is interesting, though, is that, like I said, watching this movie and thinking about this character who... This is Bruce Banner, who is the same Bruce Banner who eventually shows up in The Avengers and The Avengers Age of Ultron, played by Mark Ruffalo. Mark Ruffalo is playing the same character. So all the experiences in this movie happen to him. And there are like, a few, like... flags where you're like, oh yeah, I remember Bruce has talked about that since, I remember him referencing that, or he's going off to his little shack in India, and that's where, or wherever he goes, wherever that we find him at the start of the Avengers, and but it just seemed insane to me. I was like, at the end of this movie, by the time he's left Betty, they haven't particularly parted on bad terms.
They're actively communicating with each other.
Yeah, he's taken himself out of the equation for everyone else's safety, because he knows, like, he's been searching for a cure throughout this whole movie. He hasn't managed to find one, or he's found pretty definitively that a cure will not work. So he takes himself out of the situation and then goes and leaves. But presumably in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, there is a Betty Ross out there who is watching her TV screens, seeing the Hulk on TV going... That's that guy I'm in love with. He looks awfully close with that redhead. What's going on there?
I wonder if he's going to call. Like, you can sort of assume, like, maybe there... I wonder if there's a comic that fills in that gap. Like, there's clearly an untold story there of how they broke up, finally. But also,
it's one of the things that, for me, distances this Norton version of the character from Ruffalo's, because every so often I was reminded that they were the same character, but... I think Joss Whedon, in so many ways, got Hulk right in a way that this movie doesn't, and found a way for that character to work really well in The Avengers, that the character doesn't feel quite right. And there was... Even the very last scene of this movie, which is kind of this grinning Ed Norton with green in his eyes, showing that he's gained some control over the Hulk, or that he is at least embracing the fact that that character is a part of him, in a way feels in check with a character who goes, that's the thing, I'm always angry, but in a way also doesn't feel in check at all with a character who... at the start of The Avengers has spent, again, a huge amount of time trying not to be the Hulk, just like he had at the start of this movie.
It is weird the way Avengers kind of resets him, doesn't it? That whole thing of being somewhere hidden away where no one can find him, living in a small town in kind of impoverished conditions. Yeah. It's like...
This is the start of The Incredible Hulk again.
Yeah, it's like, I know, as you say, you know, they have referenced kind of things that happen, but essentially, the way that you find him in Avengers acts like... the whole of The Incredible Hulk never happened.
I think it has its cake and eats it. It's like, okay, it acknowledges that these events have happened and makes some reference to some of them, but also seems quite happy to go, but they also didn't matter, don't worry about it.
The thing is, it's worth pointing out that this was so early in the sort of development process for Avengers. Like, this was before there was an Avengers script by some years. And it's like, I remember them talking about the ending of the film in the sense of, if we do a sequel, maybe he's got some control. If not, maybe he's the villain in Avengers, which would have been, if they'd based the film on the Ultimates comics, that would have been the storyline.
Yeah, that was like, heavily Avengers, rumoured for quite some time.
Yeah, the Avengers fighting the Hulk.
Yeah. And even that last scene with Tony Stark, they had to do a one shot to explain why it didn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Because by the time they got to their third Marvel Cinematic Universe movie, Iron Man 2, that entire movie contradicted the post credits scene at the end of The Incredible Hulk.
It doesn't really help that they go such a different way with the look of the Hulk as well. Like
it, you say, it doesn't help. It also really helps. really, really helps.
Oh, no, I mean, sorry, no, it doesn't help their attempts to...
Yeah.
It doesn't help their attempts to make you think it's the same character. Mm. It helps with our attempts to completely forget it.
I remember being sat in the... Sorry, I remember being sat in the screen for The Avengers, or maybe, like, my second or third watch of that film's in cinemas, because, guys, it's amazing. I remember being sat, and there was a girl in front of me who leaned out to her boyfriend and said, like, we were, like, an hour in. Is that supposed to be the Incredible Hulk? And I was like, "What? How does she not?" Okay, no, I guess that would know. What? Yeah, why would she know that? even if she'd watched the previous movie, she probably wouldn't have been any the wiser, because you just get a lot of subtle hints in that movie. It just helps that when I walked into it, I knew, oh yeah, that's Mark Ruffalo. He's playing the Incredible Hulk in this film.
Well, it's a bit it's one of those things that you sort of, you assume a certain level of knowledge, and then the film doesn't necessarily give it to you.
So sort of when I say about the look of the character, I think sort of, because again, it's something that I think is one of the biggest missteps this film makes. The Hulk just looks wrong. And I read a bit about, they talked about the choices they made for kind of how he would look in terms of how he was built, and they kind of wanted him to look kind of more sort of, you know, sinewy and ripped and stuff.
Yeah, everything. But it's then I
you
hate.
Look at how, yeah, and if you look at how he was done in The Avengers, where, you know, he's just kind of, he's just chunkier. And, you know, that to me, how the Ruffalo version looks when he's the Hulk is, for me, what the Hulk should look like. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, this looks like he was drawn by, like, Rob Liefeld or something.
I mean, I'll be honest, rewatching this movie, I've always been fairly adamant that this is the worst Marvel Cinematic Universe movie. And it still may well be, but I actually did find a lot more to like about it revisiting it. For the first time since Cinemas, I think. I mean, I've rewatched every other Marvel movie, even Thor: The Dark World, but not this. And I did like a lot more about it, but what for me absolutely kills it is the CG involved in the design of the Hulk and the Abomination. Mm. And both of those CG characters, for me, are so terribly designed. And for me, it's crucial... One of the best reasons, one of the reasons why Mark Ruffalo's Hulk works so much is that he looks like Mark Ruffalo as a Hulk.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
This Hulk could be anything, and it doesn't help that, like, they shy away from showing the actual transformation so many times. It's very rare that you see. I think apart from when he's on the table when he's being experimented on by Tim Blake Nelson. That's one of the only moments where I think you actually see some transformation happening. And I just find it so hard to buy Ed Norton as the Incredible Hulk, because...
And he doesn't have Ed Norton's voice. And I know it's nice to give it to Lou Ferrigno as a little nod, but not having him have Ed Norton's voice feels like a massive misstep, because there's just no link there.
Well, is it not Ferrigno for Ruffalo as well?
It is.
I think probably the key is it's the combination of those two things. I mean, because Hulk's not that much of a vocal character, but I certainly found that to be a particular problem with the Abomination as well, which when he started talking, I was like, oh, he's not got a Cockney accent anymore. That's weird. I mean, I don't know whether Tim Roth did that as well, or did the voice for the Abomination, but it comes out sounding nothing like Emil Blonsky.
Well, to be fair, his accent's all over the place in that film, because they have the thing of, like, he's being played by Tim Roth, but they have a character whose name is Emil Blonsky, so it's like, oh,
classic British, like, name, like Emil Blonsky.
he was born in Russia, but brought up in London.
Yeah,
aye, governor.
And that's why he that's why he's got a mostly Cockney accent, but just with a hint of non-Cockney. You know? I thought Tim Roth was usually meant to be quite good at accents as well, but
I guess that's probably the final character we need to hit is Tim Roth as Emil Blonsky / the Abomination. Is he a key Hulk villain on the page? Because he comes off feeling like real second or third tier here.
In the comics, he's a prominent villain. He's also basically unrecognisable in this film.
I actually, you know, up until the point where he properly becomes the Abomination, I like him. I think he's one of the better things about the film.
Oh, I liked him, Roth.
Because I like the idea of... Okay, if you bear in mind that the Hulk... not originally, but as in this film and as it was in the Ultimates, you know, the Hulk is essentially the result of attempts to replicate the Captain America program and to develop a super soldier. So I like the idea of someone who sees himself as pretty much the ultimate soldier looking at the Hulk and going, I want a bit of that because this was a project to create a perfect soldier. I want you to do it to me. I like that as a character thing, and I just like how much of a shit he is. But it works.
Yeah, I have no problem actually with Blonsky. It's more when the abomination, when he transforms into the abomination,
all,
I'm like,
it all goes to absolute crap.
Is this the abomination or an abomination? Because for me, it could be either. Horrendous.
I find him as Blonsky just really one note and tedious.
I don't think he's any more one note than Crossbones.
Well, quite, but he's like a shit version of Crossbones. just to contrast Crossbones, Brock Rumlow from Captain America 2, like, you get the sense that he is genuinely jealous of Captain America for being a super soldier, whereas Emil Blonsky, like, sees this insane monster and goes, oh, I'd like to be like that. And it's like, well, good, because that's how you end up. But it's not a human reaction. So from that point, he just ceases to work as a character.
No, but I don't think he wants to be like the Hulk. He wants to be what the Hulk was supposed to be. He finds out what the Hulk was supposed to be.
Yeah.
And his immediate reaction is, like, oh, try it on me.
Having seen the Hulk, like, why would you want that? It doesn't seem like a relatable thing.
I suppose the natural reaction wouldn't be, it would definitely work on me.
Yeah, I think my anything I like about Emil Blonsky is Tim Roth, and anything I don't really is in the writing. I find him a particularly interesting character, but I think Tim Roth is an interesting actor, and I don't mind spending time with him, and I don't mind seeing him and William Hurt sharing scenes, for example, if it's cutting from Ed Norton and Liv Tyler sharing scenes. Yeah, not that I don't like those actors, just that I think that Tim Roth interacts with people pretty well in this movie.
I'm much more interested in William Hurt's sort of Captain Ahab routine. Like, that's, you know, that for me is the more interesting and believable villain.
Yes, I would agree with that as well. I think William Hurt's Thunderbolt Ross is the more interesting villain in this film. And that's why I kind of asked you whether he is normally a villain, because they kind of half-ass it at the end, where it's like, oh, we'll just forget that all that stuff is going on because Tim Roth has become the abomination, and now we have to sort that out instead.
Yeah.
Okay, shall we start to move into some of the actual...
shall we talk about the film?
Yeah. Well, and in fact, before we actually talk about the film as is, the film actually, on the DVD, there is an alternate opening scene. And I think alternate is probably maybe even a little unfair, because I get the impression that if it had have made it into the movie, it would have made it in as like a pre-title sequence before we get the whole like flashback montage. Mm-hmm. So if I'll kind of run you through this very basically. It is essentially a story that Mark Ruffalo's Bruce Banner tells in The Avengers, which, and this is on the DVD for The Incredible Hulk, you can watch it if you've got the DVD. It is Bruce Banner taking himself off into some kind of like Arctic snowy region. He takes out a gun, puts it to his mouth, goes to pull the trigger, and at that moment his eyes turn green. He transforms into the Hulk. The Hulk smashes the gun and then runs away through the Arctic, smashing up the Arctic. And there was going to be a cool little Easter egg in there that if you, like, freeze-framed it at just the right moment, you could see Captain America's shield in the ice as well, which is pretty cool. But that's just completely excised from the movie. And I think it makes for a great scene in The Avengers when Bruce Banner gets to tell that story about trying to pull the trigger and the Hulk stopping him, because he's the one who's in control. But I think why that's really cool in The Avengers is because it's a really interesting character beat for that guy, knowing, feeling that he's not in control at any point. Mm-hmm. Feeling that this thing always has the propensity to take over if it wants to. And I really wish they'd left it at that on the start of the movie. I think it's not only is it a fun scene and a cool scene, but it's really great character work.
Yeah, it does, like, that relationship between Hulk and Banner does inform the character in the comics, like, the idea that they're sharing a body and don't particularly like each other and one plays off the other. Like, in this movie, the rest of the film plays it as a purely biological thing. Like, they have a lot of stuff with the heart rate monitor.
Yeah.
Him saying, I can't get to this point, otherwise I become the Hulk. And yeah. I've always been a bigger fan of the kind of psychological take, which is that they are the same person, they are two different people in the same body, essentially.
The more Jekyll and Hyde way of looking at it.
Yeah.
So, like, I can see why they left it out of the film, because it confuses that relationship. But at the same time, I think it's probably better than anything they left in.
The thing is, as well, losing it means that it takes a long time before the Hulk first turns up.
And it's like,
I don't always have a problem with superhero films where it takes a long time for the title character to appear in costume, because I love the first Superman movie, I love the first Spider-Man movie, you know, we've discussed both of those. But in this case, this film badly needs the Hulk to turn up. As much as I like the stuff in Brazil, it does need the Hulk to turn up.
I think that might be the reason why they got rid of the opening sequence, was to withhold Hulk for a bit longer.
Well, it was a bad call.
It might be.
I'm sure it probably was, but I think it was a bad call.
Yeah, no, totally agree. Yeah, I mean, I like the stuff in Brazil.
I just think it's where Norton seems it's where Norton's banner seems the most interesting, because he's got the whole thing with the blood and just his kind of desperation over that, you know, and sort of you get the sense of him kind of living on the edge, living this life where he's just trying to get by, and he has this sense.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
That could collapse from under him at any moment if someone discovers who he is.
Which again, I think would be hammered home by that opening scene as well, though. I think that opening scene would work really well with all the Brazil stuff.
Yeah. Because you would see what what it was that he was at risk of, kind of thing. And it's just a shame that that side of it's like, from the moment he first transforms into the Hulk in the film, what we lose is the only interesting character beat that I think he has in the film, which is, I'm trying not to transform into the Hulk and wreck my life. It's like, he transforms into the Hulk and wrecks that life, and from then on he just spends the rest of the film running away, basically. It's a nearly 2-hour film about somebody just running
away.
There's
that quite nice moment, isn't there, where he sees the woman being sort of set upon by the guy in the factory, and he tries to walk away because he doesn't want to wreck what he's got, and then he comes back and he has to try and do it without transforming, and you know, like that stuff feels like it matters. And then from that point on, you don't care if he transforms or not. In fact, you're sitting there going, oh, please do transform, because it will be less boring.
Well, I mean, that points out like one of my main problems with the film after he leaves Rio. And because basically his goal from that point on, he needs to recover this information so he can go to Tim Blake Nelson with this information to potentially formulate a cure so he's not going to be the Hulk anymore. And for me, that doesn't work for two reasons. It's for like two crucial reasons. Like, one, as an audience member, we don't want to watch the Hulk not be the Hulk anymore. There's a reason we're watching an Incredible Hulk movie and not a movie about a scientist. Like, it would be like Iron Man spending the whole Iron Man movie trying to throw away his suit. It would not be an exciting watch. And second of all, we know that there is no fucking way that at the end of this movie that Bruce Banner is not going to be the Hulk. And the movie knows that as well, because after he has the treatment from Tim Blake Nelson, the movie, not for one second does it make us think, oh, what if Bruce Banner can't say it's the Hulk anymore? Like, the movie knows that he's going to turn into the Hulk again, and we know he's going to turn into the Hulk again. So the whole journey to him getting this cure is dramatically inert. It doesn't matter.
Yeah,
so like, the whole thrust of the movie is A, not achievable, and B, not interesting, so you just have to try and find, like, pleasure in the small moments.
Yeah, I think they probably should have made the sort of narrative thread rely more on something like him coming to accept the Hulk, which is, it's kind of something that happens, but it's not what's driving the story.
I mean, basically, I think the interesting stuff that they could have done is stuff that Joss Whedon figured out later on.
Yeah.
In terms of the internal conflict of this character. But it is there, and it is there early on. And the fact that this movie cut a scene, which Joss Whedon thought was so great, he constructed a monologue for Mark Ruffalo around it, is crazy to me.
Well, it's things like, in Avengers, when he transforms for the first time, there are people around who you care about who might get hurt if it happens. So then you're on board with the idea that him transforming is bad.
Yes.
Whereas in this, every time he transforms, he's being attacked by someone or going to fight someone who you want to see beaten up. So you're dramatically at odds with what he wants and what.
Yes, every
you
time
want.
In the movie that the Hulk shows up in this film, you want him to turn up.
Yeah, even though Bruce Banner doesn't for two of the three times.
So instead of that alternate opening that I mentioned, instead of that, we get a flashback montage, which is essentially a blueprint for the new Spider-Man movie, right, guys? that's what they're going to do in the new Spider-Man. It's going to be some title sequence, maybe animated or something, showing like him being bitten by a spider and just outlining what some of his key character relationships are.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason they did that is because there was a Hulk movie just a couple of years earlier. that's why we get that,
did
right?
The origin.
It's 5 years, I think. Yes, 2003 to 2008. Mm. It is nice to see a film recognise the fact that just because it's a new version, we don't have to spend an hour and a
it's
half
smart.
On their origin.
I do think what might have been slightly confusing about it, I remember at the time when it came out, being less plugged in, not entirely sure whether it wanted to be a sequel to Ang Lee's Hulk or not.
Well, I'm pretty sure that at the time they were more. They said a bit more that it was sort of a sequel,
like
and
a
I
spiritual
think the idea
sequel.
Of, yeah, sequel. And I think part of the idea of that opening is sort of to refresh you, but also to highlight like a few little differences.
Yes.
In how it plays out. But yeah, maybe since the MCU has developed, obviously they've moved away from that. But I'm sure when this first came out, what they were basically saying was, well, obviously it's not a direct sequel, but essentially if you watched the first one, you can sort of assume that it's the same character.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to go back and watch the Hulk and see if it actively contradicts anything from this film.
Mm.
Because in a way, that could make Ang Lee's Hulk the kind of original MCU start.
Yeah. Do you like that opening sequence that I thought was just really efficient and nice? I quite liked the visuals. In fact, it reminded me a lot of the first Spider-Man movie. The whole Hulk transforming for me always reminds me of Willem Dafoe's Green Goblin experimenting on himself for the first time. It seems like a slightly similar trope, and in both cases you're kind of creating a villain, except maybe the human being at the centre of those two characters is fundamentally different. But this movie a number of times reminded me of the Raimi Spider-Man, that maybe that was the template that Louis Leterrier was looking at.
It definitely, I'm not sure about the Raimi Spider-Man film specifically. I do get a sense that this is the last of the pre-MCU era films. Like, it has a lot about it that doesn't fit in with the tone and approach that Marvel and everyone who tries to copy Marvel would later come up with.
You can tell it was being made at the same time as Iron Man because it feels like it predates Iron
Man.
Yeah,
exactly,
definitely.
Yeah.
It feels kind of tonally incongruent with the rest of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. There's lots of, there are little in-jokes here and there are little, like, subtle pieces of humour, but it's almost like that if this film ever makes a joke, it's kind of like, oh hey, there was a little joke just back there that you might have missed. It just doesn't emphasise any of the laughs. It's like, oh, here's...
I don't know, I kind of felt the jokes actually stood out just because of how few of them there were. And when you get a joke, it happens in such a way that it's kind of like, you know, in the Marvel Universe, when you get a kind of a light-hearted gag moment, it just feels like something that those films do. In Incredible Hulk, you get similar moments, and the film acts like there's something that the film does. But because the film doesn't usually do them, they stand out by their incongruity. It's like stuff like the taxi moment, and there's, you know, and the "you wouldn't like me when I'm hungry" joke and stuff. There are a couple of good jokes in there, but they're not consistent with the rest of the tone of the film.
I tell you, the thing that stands out for me is the scene where Betty buys him those purple trousers, and they're all like, "Haha, come on, why would I wear these?" And it's it's the last moment of a film going like, you know, haha, comics, lol.
Yeah.
Like, that used to happen a lot.
Yes, it did. In the early noughties. A lot.
Like,
yeah,
even back to X-Men.
Apologising for the source.
Yeah, even back to X-Men, like, haha, you prefer yellow spandex. If the script writers have any sense, the next X-Men film, which has them in, like, stupid costumes, will make a joke of, haha, would you prefer black leather? Because it's as ridiculous now as it seemed to people then.
My favourite one, actually, it's a very subtle one, and it's so dumb, but it actually really made me laugh, was Ed Norton opening up his computer and pausing to close down Norton Antivirus.
Oh, yeah, I caught that. I'd never caught that one before, but I caught that this time.
It's so dumb, but it's so funny in how dumb it is. Because the movie really does make a point of it, because I'm assuming Norton Antivirus hadn't paid big bucks to get their product featured in this movie. It was just someone had gone, hey, wouldn't that be funny? Because, you know, the actor that's playing the character, his name is Ed Norton.
There are a surprising amount of in-jokes in this film as well, though. Like, so many references. Like, I guarantee there are references to this film, in this film, to previous Hulk incarnations that, like, most people missed. Down to the point of, like, there's a shot of Bill Bixby very early on in...
Yeah, on a TV screen.
Oh, like, there's, but yeah, the guy who plays Stanley in The Pizza Place, I'm pretty sure was Bruce... He was a character in one of the old Hulk cartoons. Wow. Like, they layer this stuff in, so much of it.
One of the other interesting things about this, and you talk about the pacing of the movie and how it feels like there is a long time before we get to Hulk. Yeah, I watched the deleted scenes on the DVD, of which there are 42 minutes.
Yeah, there are a lot of deleted scenes.
That's just the ones that make it onto the DVD. And I think, admittedly, there is probably a couple of scenes that are extended, but still, like, it's still like 35, 40 minutes, even with that. And that's a lot to cut from the movie, and a lot of that is Rio stuff. Like, it seemed like they were making a very kind of, like, slow, contemplative movie in Rio. Like, and everything was getting more explanation. Like, there's a scene where he's going up the mountain to, like, find those flowers, and you see him going out and buying all the equipment.
Yeah, the flower thread in particular is a massive plot line in the deleted scenes, and then in the movie it's, like, one scene.
Yeah, and it suggests to me that this movie got probably pretty comprehensively retooled. To lose that opening, and then maybe they were like, well, we need this opening to show the Hulk, because then we're going to spend a long time without him. And then they went, oh, we'll lose the opening now, but we'll also have to lose like 15, 20 minutes of the other stuff that you're going on with. I mean, and then later on, there's a load of Ty Burrell stuff that gets cut out, because you spend a load of time kind of having this awkward love triangle with Betty and the dad from Modern Family. But it seems like they lost quite a bit from this movie and completely changed the pacing, and therefore, I think, the emphasis somewhat, because I think basically what we lose is a lot of quiet and introspective Bruce Banner scenes.
Yeah, like, quite famously, Ed Norton threw his toys out the pram because they re-edited it without his input, didn't they?
Mm.
Like, did he even refuse to promote the film? Am I right in remembering that?
Yeah, I did watch one featurette on the DVD, and, like, Louis Leterrier's there and Kevin Feige, and there's not much Ed Norton considering how much input he had.
Yeah, but basically they edited the film to such a degree that he... pretty much why he wasn't in the rest of the Marvel Universe, was because he was like, well, if you're going to cut the film to ribbons while I'm there, I'm not going to do it.
Well, thank goodness the MCU doesn't do that. You know, superhero movies don't do that anymore. It's completely changed in the 8 years since. Can I ask you guys about the heart rate stuff in the opening? So, I mean, I know you mentioned it briefly, James, but is that ever a concept in the comics? What's the actual mechanic of Bruce becoming the Hulk? All I knew before this film was the Bruce Banner gets angry, he becomes the Hulk, which seems like a pretty clear metaphor, whereas Bruce Banner's heart rate hits 200 and he turns into the Hulk.
Yeah.
Doesn't seem like much of anything.
I mean, I'll give you a potted history of the character here, but basically there have been so many incarnations of the Hulk that, like, the classic version is Bruce Banner gets angry and that triggers this change. So, you know, you don't want him to get angry. That's, you know, that's fair enough. Like, some places might say it's adrenaline that triggers the change. Heart rate specifically, I'm not sure. It feels like something which would have turned up in the comics, but I can't think of an exact moment when it did. Originally, he changed to the Hulk at night.
Real Jekyll and Hyde stuff then?
Yeah. Sometimes he just changes because he wants to. Sometimes there are kind of weird sequences in his head where different versions of the Hulk are fighting to see which one gets dominance. Like, there are loads of versions of how... Okay.
So it's pretty fair for this movie to just have a take. That's
yeah, exactly. Like they've picked a version. Well,
I just didn't find it very interesting.
You can kind of see the appeal of, like, this beeping representing, you know, the incoming danger, but you know, it's not a very interesting device
relative to what you can do with their character anyway.
Yeah, well, then they do that weird thing of, like, he can't have sex with Betty because it will get his pulse rate up and that would trigger the change, and that doesn't feel like an honest thing. Like, it just confuses what he's trying to stop. Because, like, if heart rate was his ultimate concern, why is he spending half the film sprinting? I don't know. It doesn't really work for me.
I quite like it as a sort of a nice, easy visual device to sort of show, you know, how close he's getting.
Yeah, but at the same time, maybe he could try acting. Just a thought.
So what did you guys think of... So we get to that first action sequence, which is when Ross and Blonsky find Banner in Brazil and kind of hunt him down. And we kind of have this chase sequence, which is half Ed Norton on foot and then half him transforming into the Hulk and kind of doing a bit of smashing and running away. It seems to me very, like, I think the Bourne Ultimatum was out this same summer, and it reminded me a bit of kind of like the rooftop chases in that film. But and then, you know, Casino Royale kind of starts with a lot of that as well. I wonder whether that was just something that was kind of in vogue then, was that kind of free-running action through city rooftops.
In the zeitgeist.
Yeah, so we'll do one with Hulk.
And it does also kind of tie into the fact that, as I say, pretty much from that point on, the rest of the film is about him running away. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of appropriate that the first big action scene is that. My biggest issue with that scene is really the aftermath of it, which is the fact that it leads Blonsky to the incredibly boneheaded... Like, how long does it take Blonsky to figure out that Banner is...
Oh, yeah.
He's like, oh, this big creature turned up and we lost Banner, but, yeah, you know, if that creature's around, Banner will be around. It's like, Jesus, man, you're supposed to be, like, this brilliant soldier. Presumably you have a tactical mind, so you're not an idiot.
I didn't mind the action sequence. Like, it goes on for quite a while, but I like that whole feeling of the chase through the rooftops. And I thought it was
probably... It's probably the best action sequence.
I just thought it was really, and in general, I actually thought that Louis Leterrier's direction... I mean, I don't think this is a great film, but it all felt pretty dynamic. I mean, he spends quite a lot of time in Brazil. Like, there's lots of little montages of him putting the stuff together, which I think probably comes as a result of losing so many scenes that, by necessity, we kind of have to, like, jump from here's this little thing happening and here's that little thing happening, and there feels like a real energy to all of the stuff that happens in Brazil, that it feels like it has forward momentum. And I think the same is true of the action scene, that it feels, for me, just felt really kinetic the whole way through. I really liked the kind of the way that Leterrier had rigged up his camera and was moving it around.
It helps that the location's really interesting as well, and, like, just as a from the sort of narrative, like from the moment they go into the flat and like trank him, and you're like, oh, what, they've got him already? And then, you know, you're wrong-footed as they are about whether he's been caught or not. And then up to, I would say up to the point where he transforms, it's a really good action sequence. And once he's transformed, they spend a lot of time trying not to show you the Hulk. And you're like, I paid to see a film called The Hulk. Show me the Hulk.
That also feels like a throwback trope that we don't really seem to see.
Yeah, like, you haven't seen the Ang Lee version, but it happens in that as well.
Right.
In fact, again, it's been years since I've seen it, since I saw it, but I seem to recall you don't get a good look at the Hulk until the final action sequence in that film.
But then, so we then follow Hulk. He's back on mainland USA, and he's searching for that thing that we've already talked about. But it kind of leads to that big second action sequence after we spent time with Bruce and Betty, which are some of the most excruciating scenes in the movie. But I again quite like the second action scene. I think what really holds the action scene back, as it does in one in Harlem, is that design of the Hulk, which is so ugly, so like not in any way connected to Ed Norton as Bruce Banner. But I do like the setting. I like that this film has its three action scenes in settings that feel fresh and different. And I really like the score as well that's playing through it. I think this is a really one of the better MCU scores. Yeah, and I like some of the idea of the like sound cannons that are brought in to try and contain Hulk, and him ripping up like a sculpture to push them back. And, like, even if it's not always successful, it feels original, it feels unique. These action sequences didn't feel like plug and play from other movies, at the very least.
I don't know, I generally felt that not a lot really stands out from them. That's why I find them so difficult to remember. Like, you know, it's just like, you know, I've seen this film a couple of times now, and, you know, watching it again, I quite vividly remembered the stuff in the first act. But pretty much everything from after they leave Brazil onwards felt like it was fresh to me watching it this time. I just had no memory of it from the first time.
For me, it's the action that I do remember. Like I say, I think they do feel like a little bit unique in the way that, like, what I'd forgotten was all. I'd forgotten Ty Burrell was in this movie at all, because those scenes just don't hit home. I'd forgotten how Bruce and Betty's. I'd forgotten that Bruce takes Betty. Well, that Hulk takes Betty with him after the fight on the campus.
I actually quite like all of
the stuff in between. The only stuff that I'd remembered was the action sequences. I was like, oh yeah, when he fights out in the green fields,
the campus fight. Because actually, I think I had it in my head that the campus scene was where he fights the Abomination at the end. I'd forgotten the nighttime scene at the end, and I had an image in my head of him fighting on that grass, and that was kind of. And there are bits that I remember that I like, you know, him with his kind of shield of a big piece of metal and stuff like that. It's kind of, you're right. That stuff probably does.
Most of it's undermined by the CG for me. That's the only thing. Like, I think Letterier is doing a decent enough job, and I think that the concepts for each of the action scenes are cool. I mean, let's flash forward to the one right at the end where Hulk and Abomination fight, which is. In the respect that there are these two big CG Hulks fighting in a city is not very interesting. But I like the idea of it being in Harlem rather than somewhere that I've seen a million times before. And I like the idea that, like, I like little touches like Hulk deciding to pick up cars and use them as boxing gloves. I think that's fun, and I think conceptually there's fun stuff there. But what it always comes back to me for that is that final scene is two very, very badly designed CG blobs fighting. Yeah,
there's two problems with them, really. Firstly is the fact that they're badly designed just in concept. And also, I mean, even though it's only 2008, it's only 7 years ago, but it does kind of feel like the film can just about get away with supporting one CGI character in action scenes without it being too dodgy. But when there are two of them, it just can't hold them up. And you only have to look, you know, I mean, as I say, it's weird to think of a film released in 2008 and say, oh, you know, CGI wasn't quite there yet. More recent films have managed it. You know, something like Groot in Guardians, you know, Groot is a fully CGI character. Well, you've got Groot and Rocket. You've got two fully CGI characters who have so much character and personality.
Say CGI
can share the screen.
Yeah, this is 5-6 years after Gollum. Like, I think this is a particularly bad example of a CG character.
Well, yeah, it's badly executed is the thing. I think what it shows is that you can't just rely on being able to do two CGI characters fighting one another, because this film doesn't do them very well.
I mean, I'm watching this film going, I hate the design of Hulk. And then the Abomination turns up and I'm going, oh my god, that is all-time levels of bad. It's horrendous. Does he look like that in the comics? Because the comics need to do something as well, if that's the case.
No, that's, like, again, the Abomination is so unrecognisable from the comics, and definitely the visuals.
Pretty much the least interesting thing you can do with the Hulk is have him fight another Hulk. It's like, put something against him that's different from...
Well, okay, this is, like, my major problem with the final act is that the Hulk wins his fight simply by being the stronger of the two. Like, there, it doesn't feel like there's any reason he should have succeeded. Like, there's no character reason that he won that fight that couldn't have applied to Blonsky as well. Like, what should have happened is they spent the whole film dealing with the idea that, like, Banner doesn't want to control the Hulk, he just wants him gone. And so it feels like in the third act, the way to stop him being just a CGI punching bag would have been to put a bit more of Ed Norton in there, or try and show, like, that there are thought processes going on that are Bruce Banner's as well as Hulk's. Whereas what you get is, they trade blows, Hulk gets a chain and strangles him, the end. Like, there's no triumphant realization, there's no twist.
Nothing to Banner, does he? Like, no, yeah. The Abomination, neither
of
them
Banner
mean
doesn't
anything.
Know who this guy is. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And like you explained already, the relationship between Blonsky, or the way that Blonsky views Banner and the Hulk, is tenuous and weak at best, so, like, that doesn't particularly work either. I mean, yes, of course, the action sequence would work a lot better if you were really invested in those two characters and that relationship, but I don't think it even gets that far. It doesn't have that surface level of cool, that final showdown.
Yeah, I just think they could have gotten away with bad design and ropey CG if they'd had something for you to get invested in, and they just don't. Like, you're just invested in the idea that the Hulk will win because he's the hero and Blonsky will lose because he's evil, and it's like, yeah. it doesn't work on that level. So
can I ask you about going back to earlier in the film, it's actually the moment between those two action scenes where Hulk saves Betty in on the campus and takes her off to, like, this cave. They're mm-hmm. in a cave together. And she seems to be able to get through to him and also almost make him docile. For me, it felt a little bit too easy. And I know you kind of explained about, like, how, you know, with Betty, that's kind of the key to her character, that she has that ability. But again, to go back to Joss Whedon and the way he handles the character, I really like the way that Black Widow is kind of able to do that, but is still... she's still terrified and there is still huge risk involved, and that, yes, she can get through to him, but it's not as simple as just her showing up and suddenly he's docile and will pick her up and look after her if she's hurt. He's still a really dangerous thing because he's the Hulk. Whereas this film seemed to, like, I found it very strange when Betty showed up that he suddenly was just like, oh, I must protect this woman and I'm going to take her off to a cave and I'll literally lay down and go to sleep next to her. Yeah, it just didn't work for me. I don't know whether...
See,
but...
okay, this is one of my favourite scenes in the film, precisely because it's one of the few that feels like it translates the comics relationship to any extent.
Okay.
So, like, basically I disagree with what you've said, but I completely understand why you would have that impression.
No, but I can understand liking it, but for me it just didn't,
oh, no, yeah,
it didn't,
yeah.
It didn't, like, make sense in the context of this film.
Oh yeah, I agree with that, but I think it's the one time they get the Hulk as a character even slightly right, and the relationship between him and Betty even slightly right. Like, it's the one time they give the impression of having read a Hulk comic rather than just seen the 70s TV series. I mean, do you want me to go really deep on why that is even the case?
Yeah, do.
Okay, so... when Bruce Banner was a child, his father used to beat his mother and him as well. So the Hulk is... the reason the Hulk is kind of childlike in the comics is because he's the repressed version of Bruce Banner's id that wants to, like, lash out and fight. Like, that's the part of himself that he had to compartmentalize to the point where it became pathological, and getting the exposure of gamma radiation released that part of him. So the reason Hulk wants to protect Betty is because he couldn't protect his mother. Like, the Ang Lee film tries to cover that in detail. So maybe if you treat this as an extension of that version of the Hulk, it makes a little bit more sense. But I mean, that's, you know, that's the thing that I got from that scene that I recognised, which I enjoyed, which I completely, you know, I agree that in the context of the film, you don't get any of that.
It's more like you say, that the kind of losing that first scene and just spending more time kind of having Ed Norton's Bruce Banner and the Hulk feel like very separate entities. It then seems jarring to have a scene where Hulk is acting on some kind of
on Bruce Banner's repressed emotion,
Bruce Banner-ness. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But that's more a criticism of the rest of the film, surely.
Yes, because, yeah, no, I'm, you know, not saying that's like, it's just, I'm not saying the scene is bad. I just found it strange that it didn't really ring true to me.
Yeah, but that's the thing, that like the rest of the film fails to have you make that connection between the two characters. So it's only jarring that there's a scene that does, because it's not that the film's not trying to be, it's just that that's the only point at which the film succeeds. Mm. It's not like they suddenly decide, oh, we're going to have a link between these two characters that we consciously weren't having before.
Like,
it's that they were failing to do it.
The only thing I'd say about that film that you can potentially criticise is that Betty calls him Bruce, and traditionally the Hulk doesn't want to acknowledge that he's Bruce Banner, so he gets upset if she does that. But
right, okay. Well, I think we're probably coming towards the end of this discussion now. Guys, is there anything that you feel we haven't touched on that you particularly like or dislike or think is worthy of discussion?
I just think maybe a point that is worth making is that I don't really enjoy this film a huge amount, but it's mainly because I find it quite dull. I think with a few exceptions, such as, like, particularly the characterisation and performance of Betty, I don't think it's a bad film. It's, and apart from the CGI, it's not a badly made film, I don't think. It just really struggles to be interesting. And it also has a really terrible, terrible instance of, like, it's almost Sinestro levels of trying to set up a villain for
much about Stearns, did we? Because he spends the whole first half of the film being the sort of Bruce Banner level benevolent foil, and then in the final moments,
but you meet him and then he's wacky comedic relief.
Yeah. And then he turns into a psychopath where he's going, like, he's talking to Blonsky and he's like, did you see what I turned into? And he was like, yes, it was beautiful. You're like, what? Okay.
Yeah, they didn't really nail that.
Well, it was like suddenly, like, okay, I just, this guy that he was talking to on emails, whether they just maybe didn't handle the reveal that he was, like, maybe it needed one definitive, like, oh shit, this guy has nefarious motives. But that seems kind of, yeah, it's really weirdly handled. And then you just see this little droplet of, like, liquid fall into a wound on his skull. His forehead then bubbles and he grins.
Yeah.
Have you looked up what the leader looks like?
He's just a really, just a really big head, haven't. Isn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing that cracked me up most about that scene, the Samuel Sinn stuff, is that he meets him in the street and then he's like, Mr. Blue? And it's like, well, he's dressed entirely in blue, so yeah.
In a film that stars Tim Roth, so nice little Reservoir Dogs reference. I did wonder watching this back whether I was so down on this film at the time, because, like, I think you're right. It's not a bad movie. It's just not a good one. And this movie came out in the same year, same summer that The Dark Knight, Iron Man, and Hellboy 2 came out, which I think are, like, were all to varying degrees received very well. And, like, you're right, this seems like a throwback, whereas I think The Dark Knight at the time felt like the future of superhero movies, and Iron Man felt like something fresh because it was so much funnier and had this really charismatic lead. Whereas Hulk just felt... I think Hulk felt like another superhero movie. I feel like maybe how Ant-Man felt to some people this year, like, oh yeah, there's another Marvel film, Marvel doing what they do. I mean, I really like what Marvel do, so I'm really happy with that. But this was probably coming off the back of years with, like, Fantastic Four movies and just not particularly inspiring superhero movies. This then comes on the back of it, but also happens to be next to two or three really well-received ones.
Yeah, I mean, that's the reference point, isn't it? Like, another Marvel film in a world that has only seen Iron Man and Daredevil, Elektra, two Fantastic Four films.
Yeah.
Like, all, you know, it's that level of quality as opposed to Iron Man, Captain America, Thor level quality.
This felt like the point where superhero movies were about, like, they're going to run out of superheroes soon. Like, Iron Man feels like a stretch. It was good, but they're going to run out. But they're already doing Hulk again.
It's funny that in talking about that, you've used, like, the word superhero a few times. Because I think, again, it's something that the film, the Hulk has kind of in its armoury, as far as, like, the public perception goes, a pretty strong tool that it doesn't really play. And this film does have the nods, because obviously it's got Ferrigno in it, it's got the Bill Bixby reference, and it's got the music showing up.
Oh, yes, sad Hulk walking away music. It's one of my favourite.
It amazes me that the Hulk films have not made more of the fact that, you know, prior to the MCU kicking off, one of the most recognisable and popular and well-loved interpretations of any comic book character on the screen was the Hulk TV series. And it's weird that they don't go more in the direction of that and actually move away even from it being thought of as like a comic book superhero film. It strikes me that they might have had a bit more success. I say now it's not a problem because you've got a comic booky Hulk in the Avengers and he's fantastic. But at the time, I feel like they should have gone more down the route of playing it. And I think this film does try to do that because of the whole, you know, him being on the run thing. But I feel like they should have more pushed it towards people who liked the TV series. And they do it with the title as well, but it's just... It feels half-hearted, and it's like you could have played to that audience a bit more and set it apart from superhero films. But as it is, they're trying to pull it into the tropes of superhero movie storytelling a bit too much to really.
I don't know. I kind of disagree that I think they did do that as much as they could reasonably be expected to. Like, there are so many nods and references to the 70s TV series in this that it's kind of like they wanted that version of the character to be one that people would come in and recognise.
But then they throw him into this comic booky story at the end, fighting the big monster villain, you know.
Yeah, that's true. I guess it doesn't have the sort of Bruce Banner comes into town, helps you out and then leaves.
Yeah, it should have ended with Sad Hulk walking away. I would like to just give some props to Louis Leterrier, because I think this movie is... I don't think it's fairly well directed. I think it generally looks pretty good. It's a pretty bright superhero movie for a lot of the time. And, like, a lot of the locations, like I said, are memorable. And it feels like a movie... Like, you talk about all these references. It feels like a movie that, from everyone involved, was made with a lot of care and attention and love. But it just didn't... something about it conceptually and, you know, whatever other reasons that we've mentioned, it just doesn't come together. But I don't think it's from a result of anyone particularly phoning it in. I mean, just even, like... I mean, it's very basic-level stuff, but Leterrier peppers his scenes with green items. Like, when Hulk isn't on screen, there is just so much green stuff. I was writing down in the first, like... I was trying to write down, like, in the first couple of scenes, like, what everything... all the stuff that was green, and there was, like... all those bottles of liquids in the factory in Brazil. The first solution that Banner produces is bright green. Like, all of the grassy backgrounds in Brazil, and then in the campus, the night vision that the soldiers turn up with, and look at Ed Norton through his green, and that you've got the even Betty's dress, her first dress is green, and there's just loads and loads of stuff like that. I think, you know, keeping the idea of Hulk in the forefront of your mind, because you're seeing all these lovely bright greens, and then Hulk turns up and he's this horrible, dark, leafy green that doesn't look good at all. But yeah, I was impressed by all of that.
All I can say about that is that I noticed it.
So, on a final note, is there anything from this movie that you would like to see the MCU readdress or come back to?
As bad as their chemistry was in this film, I want to see more of Betty and Bruce together. Because for me, that's the core of the Incredible Hulk as a concept.
I mean, obviously, Ed Norton's gone, and there's every chance that Liv Tyler could be good with Mark Ruffalo, or would you recast that role as well? Because I guess you could quite easily.
I would screen test Liv Tyler with Mark Ruffalo.
I think maybe bring back Jennifer Connelly.
Yeah, that's the thing. There's no...
Oh, that
no...
would create some great tension with Paul Bettany in The Vision.
Like, there's no single actress I can think who I would think there is a perfect Betty Banner. Or Betty Ross, even, sorry.
But I think that's partly to do with the fact that the character isn't brilliantly defined, either in this film or in general.
There are so many interpretations of the character, even down to being Red Hulk. Red She-Hulk, sorry. Of which the less said, the better.
But essentially what we're saying is bring back Betty Bambalam.
I'm not saying that.
Okay, guys, do you want to give me your comic book recommendations based on The Incredible Hulk?
I kind of struggled with picking a comic to recommend based on this film, purely because most of what it draws the character from and his situation are taking from the TV series, and the only major villain is the Abomination, who, for a start, there aren't many good Abomination stories out there. And this version is so unlike them that it would seem pointless anyway. I want to save the Hulk origin stories for when we do the next Hulk film, where they're slightly more relevant. So I've just basically used this as a jumping off point to say, here is a good Hulk story that I think you should read.
Right, okay.
So it's one you'll probably be familiar with, actually. Yeah. And only on a basic level. But it is the opening arc of Planet Hulk.
Ah, good. I'm glad you have given me an excuse to read this, because I've heard it's referenced by every bloody internet blogger who has ever talked about what Hulk might be doing in the Marvel Cinematic Universe next. And I'm like, really should read that thing.
Yeah. So the issues you want to look for in the first arc, it's only about four issues long, is issues 92, 93, 94, and 95. Of Incredible Hulk Volume 2.
Okay. Where he's sent off into space to a planet.
Actually, this story begins with him arriving on the other planet. Like, the four issues that lead into him being shot off from Earth are available, but they're not that interesting
in their own
right. Like, all you need to know is Bruce Banner, Tony Stark, and a couple of other sort of Marvel Universe big brains decide the best way to deal with the Hulk is to shoot him to another planet. And this story... So they trick him into going into a satellite, which fires him off into deep space, basically.
Excellent. Seb, what do you have for me?
Well, I struggled to come up with a comic to recommend you, but for completely different reasons to James. In my case, it was just that I couldn't recall ever reading many comics starring the Hulk. I've never read Planet Hulk. I've never read any of Peter David's run. I've obviously read the very original first appearance, but so I'm going to recommend to you the one Hulk story that I can remember reading and enjoying, and it is Ultimate Wolverine versus Hulk, a 6-issue miniseries published between 2005 and 2009. And you might be wondering about the maths on that one, but that's because the first two issues came out at the end of 2005 and beginning of 2006, and then there was a 3-year delay before
the
third issue and the rest came out. The reason why is that the name of the writer of this might be familiar to you.
It's not Kevin Smith.
It's not Kevin Smith, but it's basically for the same reason as Kevin Smith's comics got delayed. It's by Damon Lindelof.
Oh, wow.
Yes, and so that's the other reason why I recommend it.
He was probably very, very busy between 2006 and 2009, in fairness to the bloke.
Exactly. And it's drawn by Lane Il Yu, who is one of my absolute favourite current working superhero artists. I think the comic gives you enough of the backstory, but because it does kind of stand alone reasonably well. But basically, so it's in the Ultimate Universe, obviously. And in the Ultimate Universe, basically from his first appearance to the general public, Hulk is kind of on the run and a fugitive and a criminal, because in his first appearance, which was actually in a weird team-up book, he fights Spider-Man, and then it was retconned in that he had basically killed hundreds of people in New York on a big rampage. Right. So even when he's being a hero, in inverted commas, in the Ultimates, the general public knows him as the guy, the monster who killed hundreds of people. And eventually in Ultimates 2, which you haven't read any of Ultimates yet, have you? This is going to spoiler some of Ultimates 2.
Well, no, I have read about
it. Okay, so in Ultimates 2, Bruce Banner, because Bruce Banner's identity gets outed as part of the villain's whole plot against the Ultimates, Bruce Banner gets outed, so he gets put on trial and gets sentenced to death. But he survives the execution, but the general public doesn't know that. So in Ultimate Wolverine versus Hulk, Hulk is in hiding, and Wolverine is sent to track him down by Nick Fury. And it's a weird series. The narrative jumps around a fair bit, and it's not helped by the fact that there was a 3-year gap between the second and third issues. But it's a lot of fun, and that's about all I'll say about it. It is crazy and a lot of fun. So, yeah, I've no idea how it stands in the context of Hulk stories in general, but it's a comic with the Hulk in that I like. So
that's good enough for me. Okay, well, we'll move on to our final section now, which is the pitch. And this week, guys, it's pretty simple. If Marvel ever get around to making a solo Hulk movie, what would you like to see happen in it? Because this would essentially be the sequel to The Incredible Hulk. So what would you like to see your Incredible Hulk sequel be? And Seb, I'll come to you first.
I would like to see an Incredible Hulk movie that at the beginning we discover that it's actually a movie about the Hulk and Black Widow, and then actually predominantly a Black Widow movie.
Is that...
I don't think they should do another Hulk solo movie, so I think they should maybe pretend that they're doing a Hulk movie, but then it's actually a Black Widow movie.
It'd be really depressing.
Disguise.
It'd be like Blue Valentine, wouldn't it? Green Valentine! For the whole film. I've named it for you, Seth!
There you go.
Scarlett Johansson and Mark Ruffalo just star in Green Valentine.
Basically, just you know the way Hulk was just left in his plane at the end of Age of Ultron. He's for the whole film. He's just in that plane, just looping around the Earth in a plane.
Scarlett Johansson watches a screen, looking for a dot.
Well, yeah, no, she's just off having adventures and occasionally, checking in on his plane to see if he's all right. But she's just going off and being cool.
Seb's pitched the Black Widow movie, whereas I have pitched Green Valentine. I'm not going to lie, I might be in the lead. James, what have you got for me?
My first idea was going to be World War Hulk, but I don't think that really fits the criteria of a solo Hulk film, because it's basically Hulk versus the Avengers.
Unless you do... Well, it could still happen.
Well, okay.
Avengers 4, we don't see Mark Ruffalo again throughout all of Phase 3, and we're like, whoa, what happened there? They forgot about him. And he's been in space, and he's turned evil, and he comes back and fights the Avengers in Avengers 4.
If I'm going to be not cheat on the concept, it would probably have to be Future Imperfect, which is an Incredible Hulk story where he gets taken to the future and finds out that in the future, he has basically given into his inner bastard and become this kind of evil dictator called the Maestro. And in a kind of post-apocalyptic world, the Hulk's evil self is king of the planet, and the modern version of the Hulk / Bruce Banner has to topple him.
Oh, very interesting.
It's a classic Hulk story. It's also drawn by George Perez.
I think from both your pitches there, I kind of like what both of you are saying in that... Seb, I kind of agree with you that right now, I don't think they should do a Hulk movie. I don't think the Marvel Cinematic Universe needs one when they're using that character so well elsewhere. But while I generally like the idea underpinning both of James's there, that there are kind of like villainous Hulks in the future. So maybe what I'm going to do is say this week, like, you both win, and we're going to do no Hulk movie now, but we're going to save James's ideas for, like, 10, 15 years' time for, like, Marvel Cinematic Universe Phase 5 or 6. So you're all winners this week. It's a tie.
Important. Most importantly, I think I should get the point in about 10 episodes' time.
I wasn't expecting even half of that, so I'll take that.
I mean, secretly, we all know Green Valentine was the winner, but mostly just for the name. I just love to see this depressing movie with Hulk and Black Widow. Like, we get the happy flashbacks to their good times together that happen in between Avengers and Age of Ultron. And then we get the depressing kind of, like, post-Age of Ultron stuff where they just meet up and say, yeah, but we can't have kids and you turn into a Hulk, and it's just all depressing and everyone probably kills themselves and Bruce Banner plays a ukulele. It's going to be very niche for anyone who hasn't seen Blue Valentine, but I like it a lot. Okay, so the pitch is shared this week, the points are shared, and that is it for this week. If you're enjoying the show, then please do subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Player FM, or your podcast app of choice. And if you already subscribed, then please leave us a rating or review on iTunes or one of those platforms. You can find us on Facebook, on Twitter, at @CU_podcast, and send us an email to cinematicuniversepod@gmail.com. And I totally read all of those now, so do send emails. You can find previous episodes of the podcast at cinematicuniverse.libsyn.com, and because this is a Film Divider podcast, on filmdivider.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Life has become more complex in the overwhelming sea of information. And life, when organized into species, relies upon genes to be its memory system. So man is an individual only because of his intangible memory. And memory cannot be defined, but it defines mankind. The advent of computers and the subsequent accumulation of incalculable data has given rise to a new system of memory and thought parallel to your own. Humanity has underestimated the consequences of computerization. Cinematic Universe returns in 2 weeks' time with Ghost in the Shell.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.